Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a fascinating show for you today. I'm really excited. I have with me a pilot, not a physician, so different and really exciting. I have Matt Renz. Matt is a pilot for a major U.S. airline and has been flying professionally for the past 12 years. He's been a captain, a chief pilot, and he's helped draft flight manuals and other safety systems for airlines. He is really interested and been thinking a lot about aviation safety and how those aviation safety principles can help reduce preventable errors in other fields, especially in medicine. And so I'm really excited to have him today because we talk a lot about thinking about aviation and medicine, but usually it's just us doctors talking about that. And I at least haven't had a conversation with a pilot, with someone who actually is in the aviation industry about this. And Matt is, I think, the perfect guest because he's both done the flying and the safety preparation and safety manual preparation, but he's also now taken this interest in medicine. And so I'm really excited. Matt, great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So why don't we start by just introduce yourself a little more than I did to the audience. Let people know, you know, what exactly do you do? How'd you get there? What was the path? And then how'd you specifically start to get interested in safety and medicine?
Sure. So, like you said, I've been flying, been an airline pilot for about 12 years. Recently I've just started becoming interested in some of these safety principles that apply to human factors and preventable errors. I read Dr. Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto, which talked a lot about some of these principles and these ideas, and thought it was really interesting and just saw the potential overlap that was there. And after looking into it a little bit more and reading more about it, I sort of realized that, despite the potential overlap, they're really it's still a lot of value that's left to be added, in my opinion, in healthcare. And so I think it's a really interesting topic to talk about. And hopefully my goal is to help hospitals and providers learn more about these safety systems, how to utilize them, and how they can implement their own versions of them.
That's great. And so, you know, I imagine you started off and correct me if I'm wrong, but you probably started off as a pilot, maybe mostly doing flying. And then it sounds like you read the Checklist Manifesto, got interested in that. How much of what pilots do every day is, you know, really thinking hard about the safety stuff? Like, it sounds like you started actually getting involved in the preparation of safety manuals and that kind of stuff. So did you take a special interest in this even within the aviation industry?
I did. Yeah. It's, it's an interesting topic to me. These types of principles are really ingrained in the culture of aviation, and we're fortunate in that way that there's been a lot of work and a lot of effort put in. They've been refined over the past several decades. So there's already a tremendous amount of groundwork that's been laid well before I entered the industry. And so the nice thing about aviation, about being a pilot, is, you know, there's always more that you can do, besides just flying. So there's lots of jobs that require that expertise that can be done. And so I took an interest in that, and it's been an interesting experience. And it's sort of brought me here today.
Well, that's great. I'm really glad you did. So why don't we start by, give us just a general overview of preventable error philosophy. What does that mean? And what do you think need to know about it?
Sure. So, in complex team environments like the operating room or a labor and delivery floor, a fact of life is, you know, humans become more susceptible to making errors in those complex environments. And the more complexity there is, the easier it is to make a mistake. And that's not a product of someone's training or skill, but just our limitations as humans. And when an error does happen and we try to learn how to prevent it from happening again, it's natural to focus on the complexity of the case itself. You know, we can take the position that because of how complex a task is, the root cause of that adverse outcome must lie somewhere within the intricacies of the technique or the experience or judgment of the person who made the mistake. But preventable errors are really a function of human fallibility, not clinical skill or experience. So when you look at aviation incidents or adverse outcomes in surgical cases, for example, you know, the flight crew or the attending physician is generally not inexperienced. These events happen to experienced, skilled professionals who are very highly regarded by their peers. And they still can make an error that results in an adverse outcome. So you know, just telling people to do better or make fewer mistakes is definitely not the antidote to this problem. Preventable error is really a product of human fallibility, not skill or experience. And so the answer lies in addressing those human factors that result in human error.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. And am I right that this also gets at kind of system design, right? Because you know, we traditionally in medicine used to be very prone to blame, as you say, to blame the person, a doctor or a nurse or whoever it is screwed up. It's their fault, right? Maybe they need to be fired or disciplined in some way. And what we realize now, and I'm so glad we have, is that that's very rare. It's usually that the system was a poor one and that the person was one piece of a system that was poorly designed. And that seems to me such an important advance to really think about. It's usually not someone doing a bad thing so much as it is a system that was designed poorly.
That's exactly correct. And, you know, sometimes there are different ways to try to assess that and to try to find flaws in those systems. And you know, we've learned a lot over the past several decades. It's important to try to maximize the or minimize the potential for preventable error and try to acknowledge that we do have faults, we can make mistakes, and the whole nature of a preventable error is that it was unintentional. And obviously we try our best and we try to make as few mistakes as possible, but there are inherent features of complex environments and inherent features of just human nature and behavior that do increase the probability of those errors. And so there are also ways to counter them as well.
Great. So I'm excited to get into that. Why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of aviation safety history, specifically, what is the era of preventable accidents and how does safety improvement kind of come about in aviation?
Sure. So several decades ago in the 70s and 80s, the aviation industry experienced a human factors dilemma that is pretty similar to the one that medicine faces today, actually. And this is all, public information that anyone can read about. But there was an alarming number of accidents that were involving perfectly airworthy airplanes that were the result of improper workload management, basic human error. Generally speaking, communication and standardization were poor. No one wanted to speak up or question the captain. Some examples of those: in 1972, there was Eastern 401, which crashed into the Everglades on approach into Miami because all three crew members were fixated on a landing gear indication light, which ultimately just turned out to be a burnt out light bulb. In 1977, two 747s collided on the runway in Tenerife, Spain, and 600 people died because ultimately one of the captains in the accident failed to communicate his understanding of an ATC clearance effectively or listen to his first officer. So NASA teamed up with the airlines and pilot unions to address this human factor problem, and collectively the industry started emphasizing several principles that were intended to mitigate human error and help people work together more effectively. Summed up, those principles were an emphasis on proper checklist usage, an emphasis on communicating and utilizing resources more effectively. We call this crew resource management, no-fault safety reporting, and the sterile flight deck rule. So after this shift, we've seen enormous improvement in aviation safety. Between 1980 and 1990, the number of accidents dropped by about half. And not only did these changes help prevent preventable errors from turning into accidents, but they also proved to be very effective at giving crews the tools that they needed to successfully handle serious problems that were outside of their control and that were not preventable. And so the lesson there is really, in any complex environment, especially when you have more than one brain in the room, there's a science and a technique to reducing the probability of errors and getting the most out of that combined experience, as we saw with that transformation. As you know, aviation has an incredible safety record today. But these techniques are not specific to aviation. They're really just based in principles that mitigate human error in general, and they can be applied to any complex environment where people work together as a team.
Right. This is such important stuff. And we're going to go through some of these key parts one by one. So let's start with checklists, because I know that's a big part of it. It's what got you in really interested in the medical implications of what you do when you read Atul Gawande's checklist manifesto. So let's start with that. When we think about checklist usage, tell us, you know, how is it used? What's the purpose and intent of checklists, and how are they used, you know, specifically in aviation for you all?
Absolutely. So a checklist essentially serve two purposes. They trap and correct errors, but they also allow the user to allocate more mental focus on the complex elements of a procedure. So instead of trying to keep track of the mundane but still critical steps in your head, like maybe for in healthcare, for example, like, you know, did we admit before surgery, did we remember to administer the prophylaxis, or is the emergency blood supply standing by? The checklist is a tool to liberate you from the burden of that, and you can redirect that bandwidth that you might otherwise allocate on those mundane aspects to the more complex pressing matters of the case. It's still a tool, and it's not a guarantee that you didn't make a mistake. It's just an additional layer of safety. So we have normal checklists and non-normal checklists. Normal checklists are for the routine procedures that we do every day, and non-normal checklists are for the abnormal or the emergency procedures that we may never experience, hopefully, in real life. The two have very different philosophies.
Interesting. Okay. So I'm very interested to hear about that, because I wasn't aware of that different terminology, normal and non-normal. So let's start with normal checklists. Although before I ask you about that, you know, I love this idea of kind of freeing up mental bandwidth, because I think this is true so often, even in things I'm thinking about. You know, if I am trying to go to sleep at night and something pops into my head, oh, you know, I have to remember to tell somebody this tomorrow. If I keep thinking about it, I'm never going to get to sleep. But if I just write it down, then I can forget about it, right? I can reallocate my brain to sleep and then not have to be focused on it. And it seems like the same idea, that rather than me sitting there trying to think, okay, did I do all the things I know I need to do? If I have a checklist, it allows me to think about other things and know that I can use that checklist as a little bit of a crutch and make sure I don't forget anything. So freeing up bandwidth seems like a really important aspect of these kinds of things. So, all right, let's start with normal checklist. So you said a normal checklist is something that is applicable to a daily, something you do every day.
Is that right? Exactly. So, when I say normal checklist, I'm referring to the specific category of checklists that get used in aviation, but they're for the things that we do every single day. It's for the routine, the mundane, the things that we have memorized. But they're still critical. They're still important. So, these checklists don't get used like an instruction manual. We don't read off each step of a checklist one by one as we get the airplane ready. That's just not necessary. We just don't need to do that. But after we perform a series of tasks from memory, then we use a normal checklist to trap any mistakes. So, for example, after 30 to 45 minutes of pre-flight prep, a pre-flight checklist would take about 30 seconds to perform trap some of the critical but mundane things. And again, it does not guarantee that you did not make mistake during that pre-flight prep. It's an added layer of safety to try to trap some of the critical steps. So the closest thing that would come to mind here in terms of the overlap with healthcare would be the WHO's Safe Surgery Checklist. The WHO developed and introduced the Safe Surgery Checklist in 2008. It was designed to improve three main elements of surgery: anesthesia safety, infection control, and surgical team communication. In eight hospital study, the usage of a customized version of the Safe Surgical Checklist reduced death rates by nearly 50% and inpatient complications by about 30%. You also have Dr. Pronovost's checklist to prevent central line infections that was part of the Michigan Keystone Project. Within 3 weeks of the implementation of that checklist, their quarterly infection rate dropped to zero. And within 18 months, the project saved an estimated $175 million in over 1,500 lives.
Yeah, pretty impressive. So you said, let me make sure I understand, that for these checklists, because it's something you're doing every day and that you, in theory, already have memorized, you do the thing and then you go back. So I'm imagining, for example, if I'm using this to, you know, get ready to place the central line, right? And this isn't exactly how we do it with central lines, but I'm just imagining. And then I might, for example, get everything ready, but before I actually pierce the skin, I then look at this checklist and make sure I did everything to prepare for what I'm about to do. So I'm catching any errors that I may have made. That's what you're saying you use these normal checklists for.
Exactly right. So for something that you do every day, it just doesn't make sense to pull out a step-by-step to-do list to tell someone how to do something. It's something that you're an expert in, you're very good at, you know how to do. You probably will do a better quality job if you just do it on your own. But before you move forward, use that checklist just to make sure you didn't forget any key steps. It's an efficient way to do it. I think, some people, when they think of checklists, they think of literally a piece of paper with boxes that they go, okay, step one, check, step two, check. But that isn't really necessarily the most elegant or effective way to do it. There are some other types of checklists, which we'll hopefully talk about later. But just in terms of normal checklists, it's a very effective way to make sure the everyday routine things that we do every day, and we still make mistakes in. It's a good way to add a layer of safety there.
Right. Yeah. I actually teach my residents to use I do write it down for them. So it's actually on paper, but also in their head, to do what I call an ABC, ABC kind of checklist after they have kind of done the intubation and they think they're ready to kind of be settled in the OR. They go back in over this ABC, ABC. So they're looking at, airway, breathing, circulation, and then anesthesia, the body position and neuromuscular blockade, and then Celsius or temperature regulation. And I tell them, so this is exactly what you're talking about, right? Is do all the things that you know to do, and then just use this to make sure you didn't miss anything. So that sounds exactly like a normal checklist. I didn't ever have the terminology to call it that. Okay.
Right.
So let's talk about how to maximize checklist value. What do you recommend people do to really get the most out of it?
Sure. So, we talked about those couple different examples and the really impressive results. So, the opportunity is definitely there. And these initiatives really are arguably only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the value that they can really add. If you look at the WHO's safe surgery checklist, it's a great starting point. But if you consider just how powerful these tools can be with a little sophistication, you realize that it's still actually a pretty primitive. If you look at it, it combines three checklists into one. It's not specific to a procedure, a department, or a facility. It combines checklist items with briefing items, and it's sort of written more of a step-by-step list of to-dos rather than precise verification steps. And that this is not any to mean any sort of disparaging to the physicians and the experts that wrote it. Like I said, it's a fantastic starting point, and it has proven to be extremely successful. But going from zero to one with a new philosophy like this is difficult, and there's always ways to improve things. And so, and the WHO actually acknowledges this in their implementation guide. They actually encourage modifications by local practices. So, to maximize a checklist program's potential, you really need to combine medical expertise with the knowledge of how a checklist should be designed, which is what I'd sort of like to get into here in a little. Now, I'm not a healthcare provider. I'm not in a position to say what items should go on a medical checklist, but my goal is to help providers use their own expertise to take the content that they feel is medically relevant and then design a checklist that is effective. So, it might seem like just listing key steps on a checklist and then having providers reference it is all there is to it. And at its core, that is the essence of what a checklist is all about. But in aviation, checklist usage is a very systematic science. There's a method to the way in which checklists are read, the type of checklist that gets used for a given procedure, selecting the events that trigger its use, selecting the optimal point in a procedure to use them, and then, of course, the design and the readability of the physical checklist itself.
Great. So tell me a little bit about how, and I hear you saying, you know, you're not going to be able to say specifically what should be on a medical checklist, but how do people who know how to do this go about selecting what should be on a checklist? So you're saying it's not just take everything, right? Every single tiny step in the thing and put it all on the checklist. So how do you decide what goes on there and what doesn't?
Exactly. So there is a method to choosing what items go on there. You know, checklists vague or that combined procedures aren't really that useful, but checklists that are too long and drawn out are tedious, and they're really often not followed that correctly. So checklists should really address a specific phase of a specific procedure and be precise in what they verify. So it's important to remember what the goal is. It's to reduce preventable errors, increase bandwidth, and promote standardization. So with this in mind, you might walk through a procedure and look for walk through a procedure in your head and look for items that are good candidates for checklist usage. So checklist items should capture steps that are simple, correctable, and mundane. So you might ask yourself as you're going through a process, what steps, if forgotten, would increase the risk of morbidity or an adverse outcome? So things like, you know, equipment tests and supply prep, you know, are perfect candidates for that. You know, things that are just more mundane steps rather than clinical or professional technique. If you look on the WHO safe surgery checklist, some of those items would be, you know, identity and consent, anesthesia and apparatus prep would, although I'd probably argue that that in and of itself can probably be its own checklist with the amount of, you know, complexity and sophistication there. Pulse ox, blood supply, airway equipment, prophylaxis, imaging, sterility status, those types of things are things that were included on the WHO safe surgery checklist that are great items to include on a checklist.
Okay. Now, let's say that I want to include, you know, equipment check, you know, how do I know whether to just have that or whether to say, you know, okay, individual items, pulse ox check, you know, ventilator check, suction check, et cetera. You know, do you, how specific do you want to get versus broad in a given item?
That's a great question. So I think first it depends on the individual, how critical each item is. You know, if we're talking about an item that if it's single-handedly left out, it could result in an adverse outcome or seriously increase the risk of a procedure. If in and of itself, it's critical enough to do that, you probably want to include it on there. Just saying, you know, equipment check, we do have things like that in aviation where it's just, you know, one item that collectively references a lot of things. And if there are a very lengthy number of steps that, are you know, collectively really testing one thing, that's probably a good candidate to include as one line item, because you could sort of think of it as one thing. You know, it's sort of binary. It's either collectively it's all done or it's not. But with critical things like pulse ox or, you know, things that could really, you know, increase the risk of a procedure, that even if it's part of a larger test, you probably want to include by themselves.
Okay. Now, you mentioned before triggering events. What is a triggering event?
Sure. So a triggering event is essentially a suitable opportunity to stop and read a checklist. It might be helpful to sort of talk about how a checklist gets read also to sort of give some context to that. How is a checklist actually used? The most common method would be what we call a challenge and response checklist. One person is designated to read the checklist. For us in the flight deck, it depends on the checklist, but you know, in the OR, it would probably be the circulator. The first thing that we do is we open the checklist by reading the title so everyone's clear on what's being verified. the reader goes down the checklist, reading off each item, and then another person, which is the challenge, and then another person verifies the condition and then responds. So like to use an aviation example, for a fuel quantity line item, which is probably on every pre-flight checklist, that's out there. The first officer would read the checklist and read fuel, which would be the challenge. And then the captain would verify the amount of fuel that we're supposed to have, and then verify the actual amount that we have on board. And then the checklist would have him respond with those numbers. So he would respond by released with 21.5, 21.5 on board. Again, using the WHO safe surgery checklist as an example, for like a pre-induction checklist that verifies the surgical site and procedure. The circulator might read site and procedure verification, which would be the challenge. And then the attending physician could read marked and confirmed. So doing it this way versus just reading a piece of paper and checking boxes has several benefits. One, it makes everyone a part of it. When everyone's a part of the procedure, errors are more likely to get caught. People are more engaged, and people feel a higher sense of accountability and responsibility. The standardized method of verification, it eliminates uncertainty, and it makes it clear exactly what is being checked and what the expected condition is. So there's no room for interpretation, and there's no question about what someone means or what they're actually checking. So, you know, most responses are usually standard, but there are ways to account for unique conditions and responses. But the most important thing is that the actual condition is understood by everyone. So then after the checklist is done, the reader closes the checklist and then announces that it's complete. So it would be like pre-flight checklist complete or pre-induction checklist complete. And again, there's no question as to the status of it. If there's an interruption there, you know, we just restart the checklist. In terms of triggering events, generally they occur after certain steps are performed, and just to trap any mistakes or oversights. So, you know, in aviation, we have multiple normal checklists throughout a flight, which occur before we're about to begin a new phase or after a series of steps have been performed. So we try to look for routine events that occur in a certain procedure or a certain process every single time that would trigger a certain checklist to be read. So it's going to be different with every procedure, but it's the important thing is to make sure that the checklist gets done every time at the correct time. And that's why, you know, choosing a specific triggering event that triggers the use of this checklist is a good way to make sure that it does.
And so give me an example from the flight deck, maybe pre-flight, like what would trigger a certain checklist? Is it just, I don't know. What would be a triggering event? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care Plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
All right, and we're back, and Matt's going to explain what a triggering event might look like.
Sure. So once a briefing is completed for a departure or an arrival, that would be a triggering event. Or if after both engines are started, that could trigger an after start checklist. Things like that. So it really depends on the procedure that you're doing, but something that's very routine, that happens every time. Okay, now it's time to do this checklist.
Yep. So for us, it could be, okay, patient arrived in the OR, that triggers maybe, for example, our identity verification checklist, right? We want to make sure before we put the patient to sleep that they and we all agree that they're the right person. Then maybe after they're asleep or, before incision or something, that's another triggering event.
Exactly. Once everyone's ready to go right before the incision, okay, we have everything we need. The next step is to make the incision, pre-incision checklist or something like that. Exactly.
So let me ask you, do you ever, I'm thinking for us that this is great and when we have time to do it. And then what happens sometimes, right, is we're under time pressure. And when you're under, for example, maybe the thing started late or whatever's happening. And that makes it really tempting to skip checklists or not go as thoroughly as you could. And I'm wondering, You know, does that ever happen? And feel free to decline to answer. I don't want you to get in trouble with your employer. But, you know, I wonder if in the airline industry it ever happens that, I don't know, maybe the plane was late coming in and you only have a short window to get. I have no idea what I'm talking about here, but to get out before the launch window closes or whatever it's called. And, you know, you now normally maybe to go through all your pre-flight checklist would take a half an hour. But now they tell you you got to be, you know, taxiing out in 15 minutes or something. Does that ever happen? And in that case, you know, is that a real safety risk? Is there a way to kind of prioritize? All right, we only have this much time, so we're going to do these most important ones, or is it pretty? Is that not really doable?
Right. No, those time pressures, you know, those exist with anything. But we absolutely do not, decline to run a checklist to in the interest of time or to try to make something happen quicker. The checklists get performed every single time, no matter what. And if that results in, you know, an airplane being late or something like that, then it does. But, these are things that are, you know, built into federal aviation regulations. Even actually there's a regulation that addresses checklist usage in the FARs, and it's something that's written into the standard operating procedure of every single airline that is something that will get done every time because we have to, because they're so important. Now there's, you know, if an emergency happens where there's a time critical function, then there's ways that we handle that while still using the checklist, and we have standardized ways to handle that, which we could talk about. But in terms of normal checklists, they get used every single time.
That's great. I mean, I think it's so important. If this is important, then it has to be prioritized. And I think we could do a better job with that in medicine. All right, let's talk about non-normal checklists. Remind us what those are, how they differ from normal checklists, and how they function.
Sure. So in emergency situations in aviation, most responses are algorithmized. There are plenty of scenarios that are not, that, you know, require the flight crew to determine their own best course of action. But, you know, like medicine, most urgent problems already have a set of predefined steps that have been contemplated already as the best course of action. That's where non-normal checklists come in. So in these situations, generally speaking, we take steps to stabilize the aircraft from memory. After the aircraft is stabilized, there are longer, more complicated procedures that we may need to perform according to a non-normal checklist. The idea here is once the aircraft is stabilized, it's far more important to get the procedure right than to do it fast. Since these steps, to isolate and correct the problem are algorithmized, it makes sense just to reference a checklist. So in these cases, the checklist will have a series of, generally speaking, they'll have a series of if-then statements or decision points that will route the user to the correct steps depending on the conditions. So, you know, in healthcare, processes or procedures where the steps are already contemplated, like a cardiac arrest algorithm or scenarios that physicians will hopefully never see in their entire careers, these can be a very powerful tool that eliminate stress, or not eliminate stress, but reduce stress, reduce errors, while not delaying the administration or the quality of treatment or care. So, you know, the key is to really is to apply the criteria that makes an effective checklist to your clinical knowledge and your clinical experience to create a program that makes sense. I imagine in the operating room, you know, if a patient were to deteriorate or start losing blood during a case, I imagine the response would sort of follow a similar arc. Stabilize the patient first on your own from memory because time is of the essence. But after that, you know, the surgical team and the anesthesia team, we need to make sure that after the patient is stable, everything else has been covered, like, you know, O2 sat, IV lines, you know, any vasopressors or anything like that, which you could certainly speak more to. But I imagine it would sort of follow a similar arc there in terms of prioritizing.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I really like, for example, Stanford has some emergency checklists for the operating room that are great. And I encourage all our residents to have those on their phone. And we talk about them a lot so that if an emergency happens in the operating room, we do exactly what you said. You know, the initial move is, well, first to call for help. And we're very lucky, unlike in an airplane where you only got the people you got, right? You can't call a bunch of other pilots from other airplanes to come join you. We're lucky in the OR, we can do that, at least in an academic center where we have lots of anesthesiologists around. we call for help and we get a ton of help right away coming from all other areas. And so then we can really say, all right, well, I'm going to work to stabilize things initially, but hey, could somebody pull up the checklist for, right, you know, whatever we're dealing with, hypoxia, pulmonary embolus, cardiac arrest, whatever it is, so that we can make sure that we're not missing anything along the way. Because as you say, we really, in the midst of a real crisis and all the stress that comes with it, it's really easy, even for experts who have done things, you know, have done these things before, to miss steps. So I think that's so important.
Exactly. And, you know, it's also just important to, you know, remember that your checklists are not, they're a tool to help. They're not intended to micromanage or unnecessarily restrict. For us in an emergency, it's written into the FARs, into the Federal Aviation Regulations, that the captain has the final authority to take any action that they see fit to meet that emergency, including deviating from any checklist or procedure or regulation, just as long as it's to ensure the safe operation of the airplane, just as an attending physician should in the operating room. It's not, you know, they're a tool to help, not to unnecessarily restrict. But, you know, it's almost like, you know, like the waiter that tries to remember your order. You know, anytime I've had not to reduce the importance of it, but you know, I've never had anytime I've had a waiter, you know, make a mistake, it's been someone who tried to memorize our order without writing it down, and it's like, you know, what is that supposed to add? You know, I'd much rather you get it right than you know, just try to remember. It's a similar philosophy. You know, assuming time is no longer a factor, what's the benefit of only relying on your memory? There really is none. So it's something that I think can really help.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more about the restaurants and the waiters. please write it down. And I think you're exactly right. Some people get, I don't know, bristly about checklists. They think, oh, this is supposed to, you know, take my job or tell me what I have to do. And I think you're exactly right. That's not it. It's that if an item on the checklist comes up and you as the person in charge think, no, in this particular situation with this particular patient, I have considered that I'm going to opt out of doing that, that's fine. But it better that than that you forgot it because you just didn't think about it, right?
Exactly. That's exactly correct.
All right. Tell me about the sterile flight deck rule. What is that?
Sure. So again, this is so the sterile flight deck rule prohibits any non-essential conversation or activity during any critical phase of flight. So critical phase of flight is defined as taxi, takeoff, and landing, as well as any operation below 10,000 feet. So during, and this is all, you know, like I said, this is all built into the Federal Aviation Regulations that anyone can go read about. During this era of aviation accidents, the investigation that a contributing factor was that crews were getting distracted during these critical phases. So in 1981, the FAA made this a federal regulation. They define what a critical phase is and what the expectation is of what you are allowed and not allowed to do. So in the operating room, a similar rule could help prevent distractions and mistakes. You know, surgeries can be very long. It can be very easy to get, you know, distracted at the wrong time. But a clearly defined rule regarding when it is acceptable and when it is not acceptable to have people have a separate discussion or even enter and leave the room could help reduce mistakes that are attributable to distraction. Again, you know, when a group of people work on a complex case together, we don't always account for these interpersonal issues. We may even take them for granted and think that, you know, it goes without saying, don't do this, but it's really important to formalize these concepts in order to get people to really buy into them. Doesn't have to, you know, wouldn't have to be the same for every procedure every time or anything particularly rigid. It could be, you know, at the discretion of the attending physician, but just in general to formalize it and set clear expectations. Sometimes that can be the difference between that, you know, something like that happening and not.
Right. So this would mean that when we are doing the intubation of the patient, it would be ideal not to have the surgeon's music blasting at full volume and, you know, everyone else in the operating room doing other things and having other conversations.
Yeah, exactly. and it also unburdens people of having to say, you know, hey, could you turn that down or could you stop talking about that? Because that's the rule. That's the expectation that everyone, that's the standard that everyone is held to. So, you know, if someone feels uncomfortable, you know, if a nurse or a resident feels uncomfortable speaking up to an attending, now it's not a, hey, you know, I think you're doing this wrong. It's, you know, this is the rule. So it applies to everybody. And then you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it is amazing. You know, there's a lot of variation. You know, there's sometimes in the operating room where everybody is very respectful of the airway and everything's calm and quiet and everyone's helping us. But I'd say that's the exception. You know, most of the time there's a lot going on and people kind of feel like, okay, they've got that and we'll just keep doing our own thing. But I think having a recognition, like you're saying, that this is an important event and we should be quiet and focused, and that's going to prevent some errors. I think we have a lot of work to do there in medicine. Tell me about no-fault safety reporting. You brought this up before, you know, as an important part of what was developed in aviation safety. What does that mean exactly?
Absolutely. So this is something that's been around for about 40 years now, I think. And again, it's something that, you know, if you're interested about it, anyone can, anyone can go read about it online. And there's FAA has made, you know, certain documents, which they call advisory circulars, that they've published that talk about this. But it's one of the most important parts of aviation safety, which has really been developing a culture where people are encouraged to report when they make a mistake and to not hide it. The FAA has taken the position that in order to be proactive with safety and not just reactive, they need to be able to identify trends in errors and identify potential problems before they result in an incident, instead of just investigating the root cause of something and say, okay, well, what was the latent safety issue here that was, you know, existing the entire time? So in order to do that, they need people to report anytime there's a deficiency in the system. So this could be a flaw in the design of a procedure, or simply a mistake that you made as an individual. You know, maybe you accidentally crossed a runway without clearance, but maybe a contributing factor to that is the layout of the taxiway and the runway intersection is confusing and it needs to be reevaluated. So they get to look at these events on a micro level, but also on a macro level. If they have 500 reports of altitude deviations going into a certain airport on a certain arrival. For one, the FAA knows that there have been at least that many deviations, but they can also compare that with data from the rest of airports of similar size in the rest of the airspace system and say, hey, there's a high probability of altitude deviations on this arrival at this altitude compared to other similar airports across the country. Maybe this arrival needs to be redesigned, or maybe the clearance that the approach controller is giving needs to change. So this way, the FAA can try to identify and correct problems before they happen. But it only works if people are willing to own up to a mistake and report it. So the way that the FAA does this is by saying, look, if you tell us when you've made a mistake, or if there's been a deviation, as long as the violation wasn't as long as the violation was inadvertent and does not involve, you know, criminal offense, we'll consider this self-disclosure a constructive attitude towards safety. And even if you are guilty of a violation, we won't take any action against your license. So this way, when you do make a mistake, you're incentivized to report it because your report protects you in a sense. So hospitals and healthcare institutions, you know, can really benefit, in my opinion, from this idea of identifying trends and safety and identifying potential problems before they materialize by instituting a reporting program with a similar philosophy. You know, like, for example, during transfer of care, providers are making more mistakes during a certain time of night. No one may realize that unless those mistakes get reported. But if a hospital sees this trend, they can identify it and they can mitigate it before it turns into a serious problem by communicating to the staff, hey, you know, we're seeing a higher incidence of a failure to, you know, say restart a medications during transfer of care between these shifts. So be vigilant for it. And here are some strategies that you can use to make sure that you don't make this mistake. Then they could stop the trend before it results in a serious, you know, adverse outcome. And so then, you know, the providers, the healthcare team can read that. And by communicating that, people are, you know, more vigilant for it and more likely to, you know, to trap those errors before they happen.
Yeah, that's so important. Now, when you, as a pilot, if you're going to do this self-reporting, do you report it directly to the FAA? Or do you report it like within your own company, with whichever airline you fly for?
The reports get sent to the FAA.
So I think that's so important, because I would imagine that if you had to, I'm going to just make this up. Let's say I fly for Southwest and I I'm going to use your example. I inadvertently cross a runway I'm not supposed to cross. If I have to go to my boss at Southwest and say, hey, I did this, and then they report it to the FAA, I'm really disincentivized, because even if I'm not going to get any action against my license from the FAA, maybe my boss thinks he's not such a good pilot. And so maybe I get less desirable routes or whatever, you know, the you know, and it's just, you know, that idea, that social pressure to not want to be seen as a someone who did this thing. Whereas if you're reporting it directly to FAA, the FAA is not your employer, right? They're not controlling what routes you fly or whether you get promoted or, you know, all that stuff. And so that seems like a much better system. We don't really have that, you know. For I'm thinking about my residents, if they made a medical error and they wanted to report it, they would really have to report it to me as their program director. And that, you know, I mean, I certainly hope they would do it, but I think they might be reluctant. Whereas if they could report it directly to the, I don't know, you know, the national healthcare or whatever organization, you know, to the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services or something, then that would be very different, because they could say, listen, we're not going to take any action against you. We're not even going to tell your employer this happened. We're just going to keep records and look for patterns, et cetera. So it seems like that's really helpful for you all, that it's a direct report to the FAA.
It's really important to not incentivize or not, you know, not to encourage people to hide mistakes. The important thing is that accurate data gets collected and so that, you know, organizations can identify trends when they're happening. And there are other ways to do that. You know, you can de-identify reports and just collect the data. You can have intermediary third parties that receive the reports and handle them. You know, if there's an agreement between, you know, the hospital and the physicians, you know, because it's a win-win for everybody. The hospital just wants there to be fewer errors and better outcomes for patients, and you know, physicians or providers, nurses, employees don't want to get don't want to get in trouble for making a mistake. So you sort of come to that agreement and come up with an arrangement where the goal is collecting data, and you know, how do we do that without incentivizing people to hide things. And there are certainly, you know, different structures and different ways to do that, to come up with that.
Great. All right, Matt, this has been fabulous. Anything that we didn't cover you think we should mention before we move on?
No, I think we covered everything. I really appreciate the conversation and appreciate having me on. And it was a very, very interesting conversation.
Well, I totally agree. Let's move to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. What's something you would recommend the audience check out? Something fun.
I just started watching The Bear on Hulu. So I'm only a couple episodes in, but I've heard really, really good things, and it's pretty good so far. So I guess if you're looking for a good show, I think that's a good one.
I've heard great things. I haven't yet watched it, but it's definitely on my list as well. I'm going to recommend a show on Apple TV Plus called Swagger. I just stumbled on this because I was watching Silo, and I finished Silo's amazing. I finished Silo and I was bummed because it was over and I'm waiting for the new season. And I was just scrolling through this, since I was already on Apple TV Plus, I was scrolling through the shows and I saw this Swagger show, and I looked on Rotten Tomatoes and it got good reviews. And so I tried it and I got totally hooked. It's ongoing. I think it's in the middle of the second season now. I'm all caught up waiting for each, you know, they release one a week, but it's about a kind of up and coming young, initially middle school, then high school basketball player in PG County, Maryland. So local to where I am, who the story as he develops as a basketball player and in life. And it is so well done and just gripping, at times funny, at times very poignant and emotional. It's really well done. So highly recommend Swagger on Apple TV Plus. All right, Matt, it's been really a pleasure. Thank you for all that you do for safety in aviation and that you're now applying to medicine. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Sonia Amanat and Sophia Wu are our social media managers. Drs. April Liu, Chris Reese, and Edison Jiang are our production assistants. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.